Okay, so let's unpack this. I mean, if I were to just sit you down in a clinical room right now and tell you that your body is currently, waging a war against itself, the actual words coming out of my mouth can physically alter your immune system.
Yeah, literally change your biology.
Right. And we are going to look at a paper today that suggests the scientific method, well, specifically the way we apply it to the human body, might actually inadvertently be making us sicker.
Which is a massive claim.
It is
Yeah.
because, we've spent centuries basically treating the human body like a combustion engine. You break a bone, the x-ray shows the crack, the doctor fixes the part, and you move on. And we just kind of expect that same exact engineering precision for everything.
We demand it, really. I mean, the entire architecture of modern medicine is built on visibility and mechanical intervention. The underlying assumption is just that if we can, zoom in close enough, if we can find the faulty gene or the misfiring neurotransmitter, we can just swap out the spark plug and fix the machine.
But the moment you step outside the realm of acute trauma, like when you look at chronic illness or widespread inflammation, autoimmune conditions, or even just the physiological effects of chronic stress, that whole combustion engine metaphor just completely falls
Oh,
apart.
completely. It shatters.
You can run every scan, every blood test in the world, and the results often come back perfectly normal. The x-ray shows absolutely nothing.
Right, which leaves patients feeling crazy.
Exactly. We are looking at a diagnostic landscape that is entirely murky, and yet the suffering is, profoundly real. So today on this deep dive, we are basically tearing down that mechanical worldview.
Which brings us to the source material.
Yes, we are diving into a May 2026 academic white paper by Dr. Bechara Sehil. It's titled The Biology of Living Coordination, and the mission here today is to fundamentally redefine what it actually means to be alive.
It's quite a ride.
It really is. We are moving away from this paradigm of the meat machine driven by some static genetic code, and we're exploring a framework that forces biology, emotion, ecology, and human culture into just a single inseparable reality.
The central argument of this paper is honestly a massive paradigm shift. I mean, modern reductionist science is incredibly effective at isolating parts. But Dr. Saley argues that we have kind of fallen into a dangerous trap.
How so?
Well, we have started demanding that life conform to our scientific categories rather than demanding that our scientific categories remain answerable to the messy, dynamic reality of life.
Oh, wow. And you see this constantly in a clinical setting.
Oh, everywhere.
Like anyone listening who has ever navigated a complex health issue knows exactly this feeling. You sit
Really?
in a sterile clinic, a specialist looks at your chart, reads a list of biomarkers, gives you some diagnostic label, and you walk out feeling like they entirely missed you. Like you as a living
Yeah,
person.
you become just a data point.
And your intuition in that moment is actually backed by the very biology we are discussing today. But to understand the solution, we have to deeply analyze the problem with modern biology first.
We have to diagnose the diagnostic method itself.
Exactly. The paper focuses heavily on our reliance on isolating mechanisms. We isolate genes to sequence them, we isolate tissues in petri dishes, we isolate regulatory processes just to map them out.
And I mean, isolating variables is the foundational premise of the scientific method. If you want to understand how a variable behaves, you basically have to strip away all the noise of the environment. You remove the context to understand the mechanism.
I do have to push back a little on the idea that this is inherently a problem, though. Because, I mean, that exact methodology gave us antibiotics.
Oh, for sure.
It gave us insulin. It gave us modern surgical techniques. Are we really sitting here trashing the reductionist model that essentially doubled the human lifespan?
No. No, definitely not. And the paper does not dismiss the triumphs of reductionism at all. What it diagnoses is a cognitive and philosophical trap that occurs after the isolation.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Well, when you spend decades isolating the part begins to appear more real, more fundamental than the whole living organism. Dr. Sakili calls this possession by distinction.
Possession by distinction.
Yeah. A distinction is just a boundary we draw to make sense of the world. So a diagnostic label is a distinction, a biomarker is a distinction, but they're merely maps.
Oh, I see. So we confuse the map for the territory.
Continually, when scientists and clinicians forget that the map is just a tool, they become possessed by their own distinctions. They start believing the gene is like a literal commander issuing orders to the organism, or they start believing the immune system is literally an army waging a war. And suddenly, the category supersedes the living human being. The patient just vanishes behind a wall of medical terminology, and the disease becomes this standalone entity that the doctor is out there fighting.
That makes so much sense. It's kind of like trying to understand human physiology through that purely reductionist lens is like trying to understand a massive citywide traffic jam by putting the spark plug of a single Honda Civic under a microscope.
That's a great way to picture it.
Right. I mean, if the spark plug is broken, sure, the car won't start. You absolutely need to know how the spark plug works. But staring at the microscopic composition of that spark plug tells you absolutely nothing about the, the torrential rainstorm outside or the multi-car pileup 3 miles
Or
ahead.
the driver.
Yes. Or the driver's soaring cortisol levels because they are about to miss a critical job interview.
Exactly. The spark plug has no context. And this is where the paper makes a really crucial clarification, just to safeguard against any anti-science rhetoric.
Good, because that's a slippery slope.
Right. Dr. Sally explicitly states that we cannot abandon physiology or biomedicine. Physiology is strictly necessary. It tells us how the spark plug fires and how the cell divides.
But it's not the whole story.
It is fundamentally insufficient on its own, because traditional physiology describes internal functions while completely erasing the history and the environment of the organism. It basically ignores the weather and it ignores the driver.
Okay, so if the machine view is fundamentally incomplete, we need a whole new definition of life from the ground up.
We do.
And the paper leans on three guiding thinkers to build this new framework. The first conceptual window comes from a biologist named Humberto Maturana. And to even begin to understand a living organism, Maturana introduces this concept called autopoiesis.
Right, autopoiesis. So auto meaning self, and poiesis meaning creation or production.
Like poetry.
Exactly, same root word. A living being is, by definition, a self-producing unity. And this isn't just poetry, it's a rigorous biological definition. And Maturana introduces a distinction that is a bit difficult to grasp at first, but it changes everything once you do.
Lay it on me.
He says, structure changes, but organization is conserved.
Okay, let's break that down because just hearing that structure and organization sound like exact synonyms.
They usually are in everyday conversation.
Right, but biologically, they are completely different. And the best way I can conceptualize this is by looking at a major sports franchise.
Oh, I like this.
Let's look at a baseball team that has been playing for 70 years. Over the course of those 70 years, every single physical component of that team has been replaced.
Sure.
Every player has retired and been swapped out. The coaching staff is entirely different. The owners have sold the team. They even, demolished the old stadium and built a new one clear across town. So the actual physical components, what Maturana calls the structure, have completely turned over.
Yet, no one would argue it's a different team. The identity of the team remains intact.
Exactly. Because the organization is perfectly conserved. The rules they play by, their core purpose, their identity as an entity in the league that remains constant. If they stopped conserving that organization, like if they showed up one day and decided to play ice hockey on the baseball diamond,
They wouldn't be the same team anymore.
right, the original entity would cease to exist. It would die.
The biology of a human being operates on that exact same principle. Think about it. The cells in your stomach lining replace themselves every few days. Your skin turns over continuously.
Which is kind of gross to think about, but true.
Yeah, but over the course of a decade, nearly every single atom in your physical structure is swapped out through metabolism, cellular death, and regeneration. The material structure is entirely transient.
Wow.
What makes you alive is not the specific carbon atoms currently residing in your tissue. What makes you alive is the continuous conservation of your organization. If that organization stops being conserved, the autopoietic unity breaks down, which is biological death.
That is fascinating. But Maturana goes even further than just defining the internal unity of the organism, right? He pushes us into what he calls the dynamic ecological organism niche unity.
Which is a very dense phrase.
It is, but it basically argues that an organism doesn't just get dropped onto a passive static earth like a piece of furniture placed in a room. The organism and its environment basically co-create each other.
Yeah, the niche is not just a geographical location. It is the active relational space that the organism brings forth. And to understand this, we have to look at how sensory information is processed.
Right.
The paper gives this brilliant illustration of this by looking at a simple sound wave propagating through the air.
Oh, I love this example. So a sound wave is just physical vibration. It's an objective physical event. If that wave hits the leaf of an oak tree, it is practically nothing. It's just a microscopic mechanical vibration.
The tree doesn't care.
Right. But if that exact same mathematical frequency hits the ear of a barn owl hunting at midnight, it represents a mouse moving through the grass. It is dinner. It is literal survival.
Yes.
Now take that same exact frequency and play it for a human being, and it might be a piece of music that brings them to tears. The physical environment did not dictate the meaning of the sound wave. The living system dictated what the environment meant based on its own autopoietic needs.
And the implications for evolutionary biology here are just profound. We are culturally conditioned to view evolution strictly through the lens of competitive survival. You know, survival of the fittest paints this picture of a gladiator arena where organisms are constantly battling each other in a hostile environment.
Yeah, it's very dog-eat-dog.
Right. But Maturana shifts this perspective entirely. He introduces the concept of natural drift. Evolution is not about dominating a static environment. It is about continuously conserving a coherent working relationship between the organism and its niche.
So it's more like an ongoing dance. Adaptation isn't a finish line you cross where you suddenly just win at evolution.
Exactly. There's no trophy.
It's just the ongoing capacity to keep moving in step with your environment. As long as the organism niche unity is conserved, life continues.
Which fundamentally challenges the reductionist view that the environment is just a backdrop. The environment and the organism are locked in a continuous structural coupling. You just cannot define the boundaries of the living system by simply tracing the outline of its skin.
Okay, philosophically, that makes sense. The baseball team analogy works really well for explaining identity and organization. But if I look at my cells under a microscope, they don't know they are part of a team.
Right, they aren't sentient little guys.
They are just executing chemical reactions. So what is actually enforcing this organization at a chemical level? Because something has to be doing it. And this brings us to the second thinker in the paper, Dennis Noble, who provides the causal architecture for this framework.
Yeah, Dennis Noble introduces the principle of biological relativity. And the core tenet of biological relativity is a direct assault on the traditional hierarchy of biology. Noble basically dictates that no single biological level has causal sovereignty.
Meaning no one biological component gets to be the ultimate boss.
Exactly. And this requires us to confront one of the most entrenched concepts in modern science, the central dogma of molecular biology.
The central dogma. This is like Francis Crick, James Watson, the discovery of DNA. It's what literally every high school biology student is taught.
It's gospel.
DNA is the blueprint. DNA gives the orders. It's transcribed into RNA, and the RNA builds the proteins that make up the body. It is a strictly one-way street of command. You have the master code, and everything else just blindly follows instructions. But Noble is saying that entire hierarchy is false.
He is dismantling it entirely. The central dogma assumes that the gene has sovereign control. But Noble points out that DNA on its own is entirely inert. It doesn't actually do anything.
Wait, really?
Yeah, it is constrained by what he calls boundary conditions. The living cell regulates the DNA just as much as the DNA instructs the cell.
Okay, because the central dogma makes it sound like DNA is an architect standing on a hill with a megaphone, just shouting orders at a mindless construction crew.
Right, a total dictatorship.
But Noble's view is that DNA is much more like a massive, dusty library of reference books. And the cell itself is the librarian.
I love that.
And that librarian is constantly looking out the window to see what the weather's doing outside. The weather, in this case, represents the boundary conditions, the environment, the niche, the physiological state of the organism.
Yes.
If a blizzard starts outside, the librarian runs into the stacks, finds the specific book on how to build a fire, and uses that information. The book didn't jump off the shelf and command the fire to be built. The cell read the environment, evaluated the boundary conditions, and utilized the DNA to adapt.
To understand the actual mechanics of this, we need to look at a specific biological mechanism the paper cites, the Hodgkin cycle.
Okay.
This is a classic example of how biological relativity functions at the micro level, and it completely undermines the idea of linear top-down causation.
Walk me through the Hodgkin cycle, because when we talk about systems regulating each other, it can sound, you know, very abstract. How does this actually work physically?
All right, let's look at a neuron, a nerve cell. Along the membrane of this cell, there are ion channels. These are basically tiny protein gates that open and close to let sodium and potassium ions flow in and out.
Okay, got the gates.
This flow of charged particles creates a membrane voltage, essentially an electrical charge across the surface of the cell. Now, traditional linear thinking would say the ion channels create the voltage. Therefore, the channels are the cause and the voltage is the effect.
a simple A causes B relationship.
Right, but that completely ignores the reality of the mechanism, because these specific ion channels are voltage-gated.
Oh.
That means their physical shape, whether they are open or closed, is determined by the membrane voltage. So the channels generate the voltage, but the voltage regulates the channels. You have the parts generating the whole, while the whole simultaneously regulates the part.
It's an irreducible loop.
A completely irreducible.
You literally cannot say which one is in charge because neither can function without the other. If you remove the voltage, the gates don't open. If you remove the gates, the voltage drops to zero.
It is a continuous reciprocal relationship. And this is the absolute essence of biological relativity. The cell relies on the genes, but the genes are regulated by the cellular environment, which is regulated by the tissue, which is regulated by the nervous system, which is regulated by the organism's interaction with the outside world.
That just turtles all the way down.
Exactly. Every level acts as a boundary condition for the levels below it and above it. You cannot isolate one level, like a specific gene, and declare it the sole cause of a complex biological state.
But hold on, I have to play devil's advocate here. We know genetic diseases exist. Cystic fibrosis, Huntington's disease. These are direct results of specific genetic mutations.
Yes, they are.
If DNA isn't the boss, how do we explain conditions where a single faulty gene undeniably causes a systemic failure?
That is a very critical nuance. Noble does not deny that a broken part can disrupt the system. Think about your library analogy. If the reference book in a library is missing all its pages, the librarian cannot build the fire, regardless of how cold it gets outside.
Oh, that makes sense.
The mutation is a structural failure. But the existence of a broken part causing a systemic failure does not prove that the part controls the system under normal conditions.
Right.
Go back to your car analogy. A broken spark plug will stop the engine from running. But you would never point to the spark plug and say, this device is the sole commander of the entire vehicle.
Definitely not.
Right. So the failure of a component simply highlights its necessity within the reciprocal loop, not its sovereignty over it.
That makes perfect sense. Okay. So we have the living unity from Maturana, the self-conserving organization. And we have the physical causal architecture from the reciprocal library and librarian.
Yeah.
But there is a massive piece missing here. Life isn't just this neutral, robotic, chemical reaction to stimuli. When you are alive, it actually feels like something to be alive. You have drives. You feel threat. You feel comfort.
It's not just math.
Right. And this brings us to the third window of the paper, focusing on the work of Catherine Pale Kaufman.
Kaufman introduces the concept of affective valuation. And this basically bridges the gap between biology and subjective experience. In traditional biology, emotion is often treated as a late-stage evolutionary byproduct, a psychological quirk that emerged only after humans developed massive prefrontal cortexes.
Yeah, like it's a luxury of being human.
Exactly. But Kaufman argues that emotion is an ancient, fundamental, biological, self-regulatory sense.
Wait, are we suggesting that single-celled organisms or bacteria have, like, feelings? Because that sounds dangerously close to New Age pseudoscience. I can accept that a dog feels fear, but an amoeba...
The paper is extremely careful here, and we must introduce a strict methodological safeguard. Kaufman's broader work occasionally ventures into highly speculative territory. Concepts like panpsychism, the idea that consciousness is a fundamental property of all matter, or even quantum consciousness.
Okay, yeah, that's out there.
Dr. Seychelles explicitly brackets those ideas out of this framework. We are not claiming that atoms have anxiety or that proteins experience existential dread.
We are keeping our feet firmly planted in observable biology.
Absolutely. When Kaufman talks about affective valuation at the simplest levels of life, she is referring to an organism's biological capacity to detect and evaluate what matters to its survival.
Okay, so a basic evaluation.
Right. A rock does not evaluate its environment. If a drop of acid falls on a rock, it is just a neutral chemical reaction. But if a drop of acid falls next to a living, single-celled organism, that organism detects a threat to its autopoietic organization. It physically recoils. It moves away from the toxic pH gradient.
Because it wants to keep living.
Yes. That biological mandate to evaluate the environment as good for me or bad for me is the evolutionary root of what we eventually experience as emotion.
It is meaning-making at a cellular level.
Yes, exactly. And Kaufman breaks down the logic of this self-regulation into two primary effective modes. The first is preservation.
Preserve it.
When an organism detects a threat, which in complex animals manifests as pain, fear, or disgust, the biological mandate is to avoid, to withdraw, to defend, and to protect its boundary. The system basically locks down to survive.
And the other side of that coin is development.
Right.
When the environment is evaluated as safe and nutrient-rich, the organism experiences positive, affective states. Pleasure, curiosity, trust. These states tell the organism it is safe to open up, to approach, to bond, to explore the niche, and to build new biological capacity.
This fundamentally alters how we should talk about feelings in a medical context. We tend to view emotions as fleeting, purely psychological events happening exclusively in our heads. We think of fear as just a mental note that says, I am in danger.
But affective evaluation means that emotioning is a whole body physiological state.
Yes. When you feel fear, your entire biological organization shifts. Your posture physically changes. Your immune system shifts its readiness, often upregulating inflammatory cytokines in anticipation of physical injury. Your metabolic resources are completely reallocated. Blood is shuttled away from your digestive organs and pushed into your skeletal muscles. Your heart rate variability drops.
The paper has this profound line that encapsulates this perfectly. Fear is not only a feeling, it is a world of threat. Your biology literally brings forth a different physiological reality based on the effective valuation of the niche.
And this is exactly why chronic stress is so biologically devastating. If your environment is constantly triggering that preservation mode, your body is continuously locked in a state of defensive resource allocation. You are physiologically withdrawing from development.
Okay, so we now have all the theoretical pieces on the table. We have Maturana's autopoiesis, Noble's biological relativity, and Kaufman's effective valuation.
The Holy Trinity here.
Yes. And Dr. Saholi synthesizes these three windows into a unified framework, he calls. The five domains of living coordination. This functions as a comprehensive checklist for evaluating the state of any living being. Let's walk through them.
Right. So the first domain is living constitution. This basically asks the foundational question. What must be conserved to stay alive? This is the organization of the system. What makes this entity itself?
Got it. Domain two is organism-medium coupling, this asks. In what niche does this living happen? You cannot separate the organism from the environment. It is actively navigating and co-creating. The owl and the mouse, the sound wave and the ear.
Right. The third domain is multi-level causal realization. This is the physiological architecture. How is this life enacted across cells, tissues, and organs? This incorporates Noble's boundary conditions. How is the librarian pulling the books based on the weather?
So good. Domain four is effective valuation. How does the organism feel what matters? Is the system currently locked in preservation mode, defending against a threat, or is it in development mode, open to growth and repair?
And then we reach the fifth domain, which is perhaps the most radical inclusion for a scientific paper. Observer distinction making.
This is the big one.
It asks, how do human explanations and human language change the action of the living system?
This is where the framework loops all the way back to the clinical experience we started with. The observer, you know, the doctor, the specialist, the researcher is not a ghost standing outside the universe objectively looking in. The clinician is part of the patient's niche.
Human language and medical categories are not neutral descriptors. They are literal biological inputs. When a doctor delivers a diagnosis, the specific words used, the tone of voice, the physical environment of the clinic, these all act as boundary conditions on the patient's biology.
Think about the classic language we use for autoimmune conditions. A doctor sits a patient down, looks at their chart, and says, "Your immune system is confused. It has gone rogue. Your body is waging a war against itself."
Such violent language.
We use this militant, violent language so casually, as if it's just a helpful metaphor. But what does that language actually do to a living organism that relies on effective valuation?
Well, the patient's cognitive and biological systems process that language as a literal threat.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor has just informed the autopoietic system that its own boundary is under attack from within. The effective evaluation system hears war. It hears incurable. It evaluates the niche as profoundly hostile.
And as we just established, when an organism perceives a profound threat, it shifts aggressively into preservation mode. The autonomic nervous system locks into sympathetic fight-or-flight dominance. Cortisol floods the system.
Right.
The very language used to describe the disease acts as a pathogenic perturbation. The doctor's metaphor physically alters the patient's biological niche, which in turn alters their cellular physiology, likely worsening the very inflammatory state the doctor is trying to treat.
This is the field of psychoneuroimmunology manifesting in real time right there in the clinic. The fifth domain demands that we recognize the observer's language as a causal force in the biological coordination of the patient.
If we accept this five-domain framework, it requires us to completely redefine the practical concepts of health, disease, and healing. We can no longer view health as simply the absence of a broken spark plug.
No, the paper redefines these concepts strictly through the lens of movement and coordination. Health is not perfect stillness. It is not having all your biomarkers sit perfectly in the median of a reference range. Health is defined as the capacity for coherent transition.
Coherent transition. I love this concept. Think of biological health like a highly complex dance routine. Being a healthy dancer doesn't mean you never sweat, you never get tired, or you never stumble. It means you possess the dynamic capacity to transition seamlessly to the next step.
Yes.
If you exert yourself in a sprint, can your cardiovascular system transition back to a resting state? If a bacterial pathogen enters your body, can your immune system mount a massive, violent, inflammatory response to neutralize the bug? And then, crucially, can it transition back to a state of quiet, vigilant readiness once the threat is gone?
That capacity to return to baseline, to shift between states based on the demands of the niche, is the definition of health. Disease, therefore, is not a static thing you have. Disease is a discoordination. It is a locked transition.
You get stuck in the dance routine, the music changes to a slow waltz, but you are physically locked in a high-speed sprint.
Exactly.
Your immune system upregulates inflammation to fight a virus, but it loses the capacity to transition back, resulting in chronic inflammation. Your nervous system shifts into preservation mode to deal with a stressful event, but it gets locked there, resulting in chronic anxiety and metabolic exhaustion. Even when you are sitting completely safely on your couch, you have lost the capacity for coherent transition.
And healing in this framework is simply restored movement. It is the restoration of the system's ability to transition smoothly between states.
How does this alter the way we view medical interventions? Let's talk about medications for a second, because if health is transition, a pill isn't just fixing a static part.
No, a medication is a perturbation introduced into a highly complex, recursively structured living system. It is a new variable altering the boundary conditions. Whether a pharmaceutical intervention heals you or harms you depends entirely on the history, the current state, and the niche of the specific organism taking it.
You drop a new dancer onto the floor and see if it helps the routine or causes a massive pileup.
Pretty much.
But again, we have to be incredibly careful here. The paper anticipates how this language could be co-opted by alternative medicine advocates to entirely reject biomedicine.
Dr. Savely is absolute on this point. This framework provides zero cover for antibiomedical misuse. If a patient is lying in an intensive care unit with severe sepsis, they have suffered a catastrophic loss of coherent transition.
Right.
They absolutely require aggressive, high-force biomedical intervention. They need intravenous broad-spectrum antibiotics. They need vasopressors. They need mechanical fluid resuscitation. The reductionist tools are life-saving in that moment.
But the difference is how we view that intervention. We don't view the antibiotics as the sole cure acting in a total vacuum. We must situate that critical care inside the living field of the patient.
Exactly.
Yes, use the antibiotics to eliminate the pathogen, but also recognize that the ICU environment itself, the constant alarms, the fluorescent lights, the sleep deprivation, the profound fear, is creating a pathogenic niche that forces the patient's body into severe preservation mode.
It's terrifying in there.
If we only treat the bacteria and ignore the effective evaluation of the patient's niche, we are fighting against the body's own biological capacity to transition back to health.
We have to expand our view outward. We've looked at the microscopic cell, we've looked at the individual patient in the clinical encounter. Now we really must apply this five-domain framework to society at large, to the medical profession, and to human civilization as a macro environment.
Which brings us to the concept of care. In standard medical parlance, care is often reduced to a billing code or, you know, bedside manner. It's the polite small talk a doctor makes before delivering the serious science. But this paper argues that care is a biological imperative.
Care is defined here as structural coupling. It is a physical causal force in the patient's niche. And to apply care effectively, the author borrows a philosophical concept from ancient Chinese philosophy, wuwei.
Wuwei generally translates to non-action or non-forcing, which sounds entirely contradictory to the practice of medicine. I mean, if I go to the emergency room with a ruptured appendix, the last thing I want the surgeon to practice is non-action.
Of course, which is why the translation requires biological context. Wuwei in medicine does not mean doing nothing. It means using the minimum sufficient force required to protect living.
Minimum sufficient force.
It is intervention guided by the living system's own margins, timing, and capacity. rather than imposing a rigid algorithmic protocol from the outside, regardless of the patient's state.
It's like helping that dancer who is locked in a pose. You don't grab them and violently force their limbs into the next position. You provide a gentle, targeted point of leverage, maybe just a hand on their shoulder, so they can find their own balance and complete the transition themselves.
That's a beautiful way to put it.
You introduce a perturbation that allows the autopoietic system to reorganize itself. Sometimes that minimum sufficient force is a gentle conversation. Sometimes it is emergency surgery. But the goal is always to unblock the transition and step back.
And this requires an immense amount of humility from the medical practitioner. It requires relinquishing the illusion of sovereign control.
And finally, the paper forces us to look at the ultimate boundary condition, the civilization we live in. We exist in an extended niche. Just as a liver cell relies on the biochemical niche of the surrounding tissue, humans rely on the societal, economic, and physical niche of their civilization.
Yes.
And this extended niche can be salugenic, meaning it promotes coherent transition and health, or it can be profoundly pathogenic.
A civilization becomes pathogenic when it normalizes chronic threat. When you build a society where air pollution, unstable housing, normalized violence, structural inequality, and constant economic anxiety are just the baseline reality, you are constructing an inherently pathogenic niche.
And what does a living organism do when placed in a niche filled with chronic threat? It engages its effective evaluation, it evaluates the environment as hostile, and it locks into preservation mode.
Right.
The biology does exactly what it evolved to do. It upregulates inflammation, it floods the system with stress hormones, it withdraws from development, and it maintains a state of hypervigilance.
And here is the true tragedy of the reductionist model. When individuals inevitably begin to break down under those conditions, when they develop chronic fatigue, autoimmune disorders, metabolic syndrome, or severe anxiety, a pathogenic civilization will blame the individual.
Always.
The medical system will isolate the patient, point to their elevated biomarkers, and treat the illness as a mechanical failure of their individual body.
The system demands that the individual fix their broken spark plug while completely ignoring the fact that the entire engine is submerged in water. I really want to emphasize how incredibly validating this is for anyone listening who struggles with chronic health issues.
It really is.
If your daily environment demands unrelenting vigilance, like if you are working 3 jobs, breathing polluted air, and scrolling through a terrifying news cycle every night, your biology is actively adapting to that threat. When you get sick, it is not a mechanical failure. Your body did not betray you.
Not at all.
Your body is accurately, perfectly, and desperately coordinating with a highly toxic niche.
It's a profound reframing. Life is always making sense of the conditions it is given. The illness is often a logical, biological adaptation to an illogical environment.
So we have covered an immense amount of ground today. Let's pull the threads together for you. We are not isolated, broken meat machines waiting for a mechanic to swap out our parts. We are not blindly dictated by a sovereign genetic code sitting in an ivory tower. We are living, feeling coordinators. We are continuously and dynamically reacting to our physical, emotional, and linguistic environments across multiple levels of biology.
Exactly.
Life must not be forced to fit our rigid scientific distinctions. Our scientific distinctions must remain answerable to the messy, dynamic, beautiful reality of living.
The paper is ultimately a call for a biological science rooted in a relationship rather than isolation.
And we want to leave you with a final unexamined thought sparked by this framework. We just spend a significant amount of time discussing domain 5. We establish that human care, the actual language, tone, and presence of a clinician, acts as a literal biological force.
Yes, it does.
It can create a salugenic niche of safety, allowing the patient to enter development mode, or it can create a pathogenic niche of threat, locking them into preservation.
The relational domain is not a luxury. It is a boundary condition required for healing.
Consider the implications of that in our current technological landscape. Right now, there is a massive push in healthcare to replace triage nurses, general practitioners, and therapists with AI diagnostic chatbots. The goal is efficiency,
of course.
But if we accept Dr. Sasi's framework, what are the physiological implications of outsourcing the relational domain of care to a machine?
An algorithm can process data and map distinctions. It can find the broken spark plug. But a machine is inherently incapable of autopoiesis. It is incapable of effective evaluation. It cannot emotion.
So if a patient's capacity to achieve a coherent transition to heal relies in part on the structural coupling with a caring living observer, what happens when the observer is dead code? Are we fundamentally stripping away a biological requirement for human healing in the name of efficiency?
It's a scary thought.
It really is. Something to think about the next time you get an automated algorithmic health alert on your phone. Because at the end of the day, when you step into a clinic, you don't just want a machine to point at a jagged white line on a scan. You need another living being to actually see you.